When the man comes away, Brad Kelly is connecting to audio. This is Art of Darkness After Dark, the Patreon episode. And hopefully you just listened to the Johnny Cash episode. There he is. There's the man.
There we go.
The man in black.
Yeah. I just realized it got dark in here while we were doing that episode.
Perfect. The mirror being painted black. What an image.
Right. There's also a story about him in the man in black pilled up phase where he was wearing some brown boots. And he looked down at him. He's hanging out with some people. And he looked down at him and said, "Hey, man, the man in black can't be wearing brown boots." And so he painted his boots black. Now, where he had black paint, why he had this black paint with him all the time, like, I don't really know. But
I think it probably was on his rider at that point.
Right?
Oh, look, I need a can of
black paint.
Yep, I need a can of black paint in every room.
All right.
There is a man going around taking names, and he decides who to free and who to blame. Everybody won't be treated all the same. There'll be a golden ladder reaching down when the man comes around. Ugh. Come on! Oof. Come on,
dude. There's a great, did you ever see the show? It was an HBO series like back in the Sopranos days called Generation Kill. Did you ever see that?
I did not.
It's pretty good. It's like a biopic, I guess. It's based on an article written by this Rolling Stone journalist who was embedded with the first recon Marines to enter Iraq.
Yeah.
It's kind of topical a little bit as far as we get topical, I guess, because the Afghanistan stuff going on now. But, it follows these guys on their, I guess, their tour. And the last episode, they're all watching this video that one of the guys in the crew put together. And Johnny Cash's The Man Comes Around is playing. And like one at a time, the guys from the crew just leaves the room while they're watching this, right? Because they realize, because it's just like, they realize it was like the most important thing that had ever happened in their life. But it's not all good, right? Like the video, as they're watching it, it's like these mixed emotions, and then that song is playing. It's pretty powerful little bit of cinema.
They want us to believe that we're having our generation's Saigon moment, but I'm not sure I even believe it. It's such a fractured reality. That's neither here nor there. But
right.
Johnny Cash was alive. Probably, I think he was alive when the Afghanistan war had begun, technically.
Yeah, he died in 2003. So yeah, he knew it was coming if he wasn't. Yeah.
Yeah, man. Well, so we like to talk on this, these After Dark episodes about kind of the show prep and what did you do and how did you get to where you landed and what are your big takeaways? I mean, I want to hear it all. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, talking about prep, this was one of those, probably this isn't true of every episode we've done. So, I'll call them my episodes, the ones where I did the research. But this one and probably the Kafka episode and probably the Burroughs episode, this is when I've like technically been preparing for like 15, 20 years. You know what I mean?
I was built to record this podcast episode about Johnny Cash.
Right. Yeah. Because dude, sure. I remember rolling around in my car when I was a teenager, you know, and you got your CDs. At that time you got your stack of CDs. And I mean, what I had in there, I had a lot of stuff. You know, I had grunge music, I had some Nirvana and Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, and I had the Wu-Tang Clan, and I had a couple other rap albums. Like Stone Temple Pilots and some electronic music, like Prodigy, like some of that
Pearl
stuff.
Pearl Jam,
I had Johnny Cash's Live at Folsom Prison, and he released at the same time that was coming, or at the same time the Rick Rubin stuff was happening, they released a three disc retrospective called Love, God, and Murder. And each
they
album,
really nailed the aesthetic with that Rubin stuff.
They Clearly really they, did. That was what he was meant to make ultimately. Yeah. Yeah. He had to go through all these other paraginations to get there. But I didn't have the Love and God discs. I just had the Murder disc. And so I listened to those on repeat, man. The Live at Folsom. And this is, I never even had any of the Rubin albums on CD, but I had I had the murder disc. I had the whole thing, but the other two stayed at home while I was driving around in my Plymouth Duster or whatever it was. I had the murder disc and I had Live at Folsom Prison. So I've been enamored with, and I don't know when I first heard of him, but I've been enamored with him since I was 16 or 17 years old, you know, and I'm obviously not the only person. So the preps kind of started then, and I had read his autobiography probably 10 or 15 years ago. And then, you know, decided when we started doing this show, like making a sketch of like, well, who are people that I want to do? I was like, well, it's got to do Johnny Cash eventually, like got to get around to him. So it kind of started there. And then I read this biography, which is really good. It's called just Johnny Cash, The Life. It's a thick one. I mean, this might be the most reading I've done for an episode yet, just because this thing's like 750 pages long, very detailed, just sort of blow by blow the life of Johnny Cash. And there's so much cool stuff I skipped.
All of trying these to turn it into a coherent narrative. The business in the cave and...
Right. He had these moments. He also had this man. So Johnny Cash did like... I'd skipped over all the Billy Graham stuff. Like Johnny Cash was in deep with Billy Graham and he would play these crusade shows that were like, you know, he played to an auditorium of Billy Graham fans. And then Johnny Cash, I don't even know if it was published, but he wrote or tried to write a book called The Man in White, which was going to be a biography of St. Paul.
Hmm.
So like he took the religion stuff really serious, and like he took an extended trip to the Holy Land with family and all of that. So like the religion stuff was ran pretty deep in his veins for sure.
Did he reconcile with his father? They make a point of it in the film.
I never came across in the biography that he did.
Mm.
Maybe he did. But I haven't really seen any of that. There was a glimmer that his dad might have been quasi proud of him when he played at the Nixon White House.
Tricky deck. The president has asked for me to play the White House. So it's a pretty big deal. But then,
right. And they were from a family that was like, it didn't even matter if the president was Republican, Democrat. It wasn't like it is now for them. It was like, that's the president of the, you stand when he enters the room.
Oh, sure.
Kinda, you know what I mean?
I mean, I might talk a big game on Twitter, but if I, for whatever reason, was in the White House, I would stand when Biden enters the room.
Yeah.
You have to have the minimum of decorum.
Right.
You know?
Well, here's the thing. Whoever the president is, whatever you think about him, whatever happens when he's in the room is a historical moment. That is a history.
It's a big deal. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And if you're an artist and you're invited to the White House, you go.
Right. Yeah. Right. So I think there probably was a little bit of moment of that. I remember I did read that when Billy Graham, who was more famous than Joel Osteen. Okay. Billy Graham is having dinner at the Cash House and Johnny invites his dad. Johnny thought his dad would be impressed and his dad didn't say anything.
There's that funny thing of I'm always your pa. I'm always your dad. And you're never going to be bigger than me. You're never going to beat me.
There's a dark thing where like you're supposed to, I think, transmute that into like, man, didn't I do such a good, something along the lines of, didn't I do such a good job as a father that you turned into this man?
I'm so proud of you, son.
Right,
like, and you wonder what would have happened if, was it, Jack, the brother?
Jack, the older brother,
Jack had lived, if it would have been mellowed.
Yeah.
A lot of marriages, you know, won't survive the death of a child. So the fact that they kept that marriage together is an accomplishment on its own. I can't imagine. I can't imagine.
Right.
So what an American life, and what a story to think about being born in 1935 and living to 2003. And
There's a bit of a, like a almost, he is the closest Cash of the characters we've done so far. He is the closest to being like a Forrest Gump. Kind of like, right? Like all like the classic American late 20th century moments happen. And there's sort of Johnny Cash is sort of in the background someplace.
He's
in the Nixon White House and he's got his own TV show. That's like sort of in competition with all the other shows you hear about it. Bob Dylan knows who he is. And like, and Elvis, he's there on Elvis's first show. And like, there's a little bit of that, like, not that he like stumbled dumbly into it the way that Gump did, but like there's something like that going on. He's like, oh, now I'm at the MTV New Movie Awards. Like, oh, okay.
Music Awards, like, but a kid off the farm.
Right.
Off the, what was it called again?
Colonization Project Number One.
I can't get over that. Oh, man. Which,
and I loved the fact when I came across that it was like a property developer's get-rich-quick scheme.
Of course. Like, that's all America's ever been. Man, that's right. All it's ever going to be. Right. It's a big used car lot with a military.
Right.
There's
right.
no there. Right. There's all, you know, somebody's always grifting.
Right.
Yeah, of course. I mean.
Right. And there's, I mean, you talk about like if Jack would have lived, this is, and you know, this is part of the sort of theme or the thing that we're trying to figure out in the show, I think, overall is like, okay, say Jack survives and say Johnny never gets hooked on pills and he moves to Little Rock instead of Memphis. Do you get Johnny Cash?
He probably ends up working for the Clintons and then ends up getting like whacked in the 80s.
He's a pilot on those drug planes they landed in.
Yeah, he has some secrets. Yeah.
No, I know. You know what I mean? You just kind of get some of these elements and you're like, man, I don't know.
No, that's it. This is the cliche that we're in battle with,
right.
But it's a cliche for a reason. Does the darkness contribute to the art? And of course it does.
Yeah,
I mean, this guy is the example of it, the arch example of it.
There is, and I wanted to mention it because it didn't even occur to me until I was reading that thing that Jack said and like his deathbed, essentially. There is a later Johnny Cash song, I think it's Spiritual or maybe Unchained, where he actually says one of the lines that he said that Jack said. And it didn't hit me until I was like literally reading it to you that was, and so that was omnipresent in his life. The fact that his brother and his best friend and a person who was like easy to put on a pedestal as this, like, this is the kind of person you want to be.
Right. And then all of this pressure to replace what the brother was. And it sounds like the brother was outgoing, charismatic, deeply religious, and almost like a preacher. So you have this thing with Johnny Cash's music where he's doing a similar thing.
Yeah.
But then he ends up being this bad boy.
Right.
This is this real serious outlaw.
Yeah.
How much of it is real and how much of it is the myth that you're creating.
Right. Right.
And it all gets kind of mixed together.
And you get lost, and you would get lost in it, I would think, right? Like, you know, I'm a bad boy, but it's because I have a serious drug problem.
Right. I just went to Juarez to score some pills, and now I've been arrested.
Right, and that might sound cool, I guess, but like it wasn't cool when it happened.
And, I mean, and these shows he played in the prison have no whiff of exploitation.
No.
Bull.
Not, I don't think so.
Not one bit. I don't think that anybody, that idea, but another artist, you could see you could see that it could maybe be exploitative or whatnot.
Yeah.
There's no pretense there.
He genuinely cared about it. He played a song written by a guy that was in the audience.
Which
Stone
one was
Stonehouse. Oh, can't remember it now. Something Stonehouse.
Well, and there's so much humor too. I mean, he sings that song about the guy who's about to go hang at the gallows.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they're laughing. And
Yeah. 10 more minutes to go.
to go. And it's pretty funny.
It's funny and it's good. And like, it's well put together song
because
it like builds up and it's like.
Yeah, it's clever. And if you have this idea that this music is somehow not sophisticated or whatnot, you're completely so far off base. It's just ridiculous.
The
musicianship isn't. This isn't Juilliard we're talking about, but that's not what matters.
No. I mean, that's the thing is it's like, okay. I mean, I'll even buy it that it's not sophisticated, but like, man, I don't really even care. Like, he's a storyteller, and he's telling his kinds of stories and some of his storytelling songs are the best. And I know he didn't write, say, A Boy Named Sue, but like, the way he carries that whole song, right? Like even at the end, there's a great thing. He's like, and if I have a son, I'm going to name him Bill or George
or Jim or Tom or anything but Sue.
It's just the way it's presented. Yeah, it's fantastic, yeah, yeah. Right? It's like, it's got, that's, that song has like great, like stand-up comedian timing almost, right?
For sure.
Yeah.
I love too that, and I didn't go into this in the main episode, but The Downward Spiral is one of my favorite albums.
Yeah, it's great.
One of my favorite things to do is to go to the Tate Modern in London, the Modern Art Museum, on my own, with my headphones in, and I get myself a lot of espresso, and I get jacked up on espresso, and I listen to The Downward Spiral as I walk around this great Modern Art Museum, and I get ideas and plays come to me, and it's like this almost kind of, you never know what you're going to see, and it's wonderful. And the fact that normies don't know that that's a cover, a Nine Inch Nails cover, gives me no end of pleasure.
Right.
And of course, it's not like it's that obscure.
It's not, but, really.
But I remember the first time I heard it, I was like, oh, shit.
He's doing hurt? He's doing like that song.
Like, and what that song means to like somebody who grew up in the 90s and who,
well, dude, that was
that
a
album
song,
meant.
That was a song too, like, I never really thought about it that much, but like remembering, I mean, I listened to, I had a relationship with that song Hurt, you know, before Johnny Cash covered it. Mm-hmm. And I think obviously a lot of other people did too, but that was a song that like, it wasn't a song that you and your friends knew together. Like,
no, because like it's like the end of a suicide note.
Right.
It's a song about suicide.
Yeah.
Let's be real.
Every person who the original Nine Inch Nails version resonated with, that was like a private.
You wouldn't put it on at a party.
Right.
You're not hanging out going, you know, I'm going to put on the, you might play a few cuts off the Downward Spiral, but that's not an album you would put on and just press play at a party.
No.
And so you especially by the time you get to Hurt. Yeah. Right. It's not.
So you have, you know, 10 million or 100 million people who have this personal relationship with this song, and then Johnny Cash comes out and he does this
the greatest cover of all
version
time. I have no qualms about calling it the greatest cover of all time. I think that the number of plays, it's like his number one played song on Spotify, which is just like hilarious
to me
when I think about Johnny Cash and my great aunt and great uncle and listening to Ring of Fire all the way through to now. It's just surreal. It's too funny. But his cover of that song turns it into something redemptive.
Yeah.
And he knows he's doing it. He knows what the song is about. And he knows that what it means, and he makes it his own. It's perfect.
Yeah. And you know, so he was a great songwriter. Johnny Cash was a great songwriter. He was a great song performer and interpreter as well. It's a sort of a Johnny Cash deep cut, but it's originally a Bruce Springsteen song called off of Nebraska called Highway Patrolman. And it's head and shoulders above Bruce Springsteen's version, in my opinion. And because like you believe that Johnny Cash is this highway patrolman. It's got all of the pathos and all the feeling of it without being cheesy or cringy or overplaying it. It's just, it's got the exact vibe that song is meant to have. And Bruce Springsteen couldn't quite pull it off, but Johnny Cash could. So
somebody was telling me that Johnny Cash is, they were watching some videos of him and he had the most relaxed guitar playing of anybody they've ever seen.
Really?
Yeah. Somebody was telling me that. And they were also telling me that apparently back in the day when he was doing duets with June, he would play like the top third of the fret board of the guitar in order to have room. So the rest of the guitar would be behind June, behind the partner. He'd be playing the top of it.
Yeah, I do see him in videos.
He was a virtuoso
on
the guitar.
Means.
I mean, let's not pretend. I mean, he was a great guitar player on it.
Yeah,
he wasn't Prince, but I mean, he was.
Right. Yeah, he was beyond competent. And in you know, he arranged a lot of this music too. Not all of it, and it depended what producer he was working with, but I mean, literally the first American album, the first Rick Rubin album, Rick Rubin didn't really do anything. I think what they did is they just recorded Johnny playing. Rick would might be like, hey, you know what? We should probably redo that verse because it's a little gravelly or a little weird or whatever. But like, other than that, it was just like Johnny plays and I record it and I just try not to make my chair creak, you know, like, yeah. And it works, right? It's an amazing album. So yeah, this is.
Can you think of a greater? Is there a greater comeback?
I can't imagine. Like,
I'm trying to think of who would be even like a greater comeback than that.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think it, because Elvis ended up dying on the toilet.
Right, right.
That didn't make it.
I mean, you think about the other people. So to have such a great comeback, you would have to first hit such a high, right? So that limits who even could pull it off. This would be like if Madonna came out with an album now.
Right.
That was like...
That crossed over and became cultural. Right.
And it wasn't just listened to by Madonna fans, but was like poignant and hit everybody, punched everybody in the heart somehow. Right.
Yeah, it hasn't happened. And like I guess Bob Dylan kind of maybe went away a little bit. And then he had his renaissance, but it doesn't quite feel the same somehow.
Yeah, but see, Bob Dylan's, this is the thing. I love a lot of early Bob Dylan stuff, and the late stuff is sort of hit or miss to me. But like Bob Dylan now, I feel like I'm just being told by NPR that I'm supposed to like it.
Yeah. There is a bit of that. He's had some great records here recently, but it's not quite the same thing. I think not, and I would never say anything, you know, ill of Bob Dylan, but
he's
like
a genius.
I think Bob Dylan didn't go away as hard as Johnny Cash.
That's true. Right? Yeah.
And you have that whole problem with Johnny Cash and country music and everything where it was considered passé or lowbrow or outsider music or something. It just wasn't, it hadn't. And so this Rick Rubin project just kind of was part of that whole thing that happened in the 90s where the entire, you know, the Coens and the Old Brother Where Art Thou soundtrack, where that Gen X, for all their problems, went about the work of reclaiming this stuff
and
making sure that it wasn't just totally lost to the MTV garbage.
That's a good point. You know, I never thought, when did the Old Brother Where Art Thou come out?
That was in the 90s. Or no, that was in the early aughts.
Yeah.
So the Rubin thing is all.
So 2000. It's the same. Yeah, it's the same time period.
It's that same. There was a big, what's the name of the, is it T-Bone Burnett? And that whole clan of people who did the work
That's arguably the greatest soundtrack.
Yeah.
Like, you could put that.
That was so huge.
It's enormous. I mean, I still listen to
that soundtrack. I think made more money than the movie.
Probably. It's beautiful. Yeah.
It's a great movie. That movie's so funny.
It's a great movie.
Oh, my hair. I'm a Dapper Dan man. Just this like arch Americana.
Yeah. I never thought of putting the Cash resurgence with that, but that actually makes total sense.
It's all
sense.
Part of the same project. Yeah.
Yeah,
and you're if right. you're and this stuff, it's not like it's that. It's two clicks away on Spotify, and then you're into outlaw country. Right. I had a girlfriend who was really into outlaw country, and there's this whole world of it.
There is.
And it brings you into this Americana in a way that's really earnest and genuine and fun. And you get out of that trap of, I don't like country music. It's like, well, what, you know?
Yeah, how much
have you really ever really put on like a Willie Nelson record and give it a shot? You know,
right.
or do you just have this idea that it's like old fuddy music? It's like,
Yeah. Well, I think there is very, you'd be hard pressed to find something more facile and dumb than like 90% of pop country
that
country stage.
Of course.
Most of that stuff is just garbage.
The stuff that you pull over into a Valero gas station in Oklahoma, and what you're going to hear, it just makes you want to blow your brains out.
It's clearly manufactured, it's just garbage.
That's not the music we're talking about.
It's not. No. I mean, this is, you know, in the other genres of music have a similar kind of thing. It seems a little more striking to me in country music, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, rap music certainly has this, right? There's, you know, like.
Yeah. I mean, there's like rock and quote unquote rock and roll that sounds like it was recorded to be played in an elevator.
Absolutely, yeah.
Or like an old Chicago in the suburbs.
Right.
And you just go, this is not music. This is terrible. This is, what is this guy singing about? Oh my God, I want to, you know, this is just the worst.
But you can't throw the whole genre out.
No,
and
of
it's
course.
Like, and I bet there are, and I guess I was probably this person too. It was like, I don't listen to any country music, well, except Johnny Cash.
Right.
It's like he's the one caveat that you would allow yourself.
Everybody has that. Yeah. And it's like, well, maybe go a few steps deeper because there's a couple
other people in that orbit for sure.
As
good as anybody.
I judge the hell out of places based on the music they play.
Oh yeah.
I will formulate entire opinions about cities based on the music. Like Philadelphia is a cool town because when I go around Philadelphia, it's all independent. I mean, it's not all independent, but if you walk around Philly, you go into like some little antique store, they'll be playing Sisters of Mercy.
Right.
They'll be like a goth gal behind the counter. I'm like, yes. Awesome.
See, you know, dude, I think this is interesting because I totally agree with you. I think this might be a symptomatic of what's going wrong in Detroit right now.
Mm.
The music, I don't go out enough to know.
Yeah.
But it doesn't seem like the music is good when you go out anymore. That's interesting.
That is a bummer because it's so huge and people just, you cannot. I mean, dude, you go into a bar, you know, or a restaurant. I'm sober now, but you go into a restaurant, you have some wings and Johnny Cash comes on.
Yeah.
Nobody at the bar is unhappy about that.
Right. Right.
Nobody's going, God, you know, stop putting on the Johnny Cash. Like
you're
at the very least, most everybody's in agreement. It changes the whole mood of the entire place.
Right.
It brings in a slice of authenticity.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Most of the rest of the jukebox just is not going to give you.
Well, that was one thing that I learned in Austin, actually, when you went to a bar and they had jukeboxes. Because I remember hanging out with you at the bar and you'd be like, that place has a good jukebox.
Yeah.
Right? And you go and you put like 10 songs on or whatever. But the cool thing was they had pre-curated your options, right? That's what the jukebox is all about. It predetermines you. You know, you've got, say, 1,000 songs you can play, but it's only these 1,000 songs, and it's not any other 1,000 songs.
No duds.
Right.
No duds in the entire jukebox.
Yeah, and then you go to a place where it has one of those like internet ones. Where, like, you can play any song ever,
and it's then
like
suddenly
this isn't going to go well.
It's 9:30. There's hockey on the television. Maybe you're hungover, and then some idiot puts on Britney Spears, and you want to blow your brains out.
Right.
Free Britney.
Right.
Free Britney.
It's not
out of the jukebox.
Against her.
Yeah.
Get her out.
Right. Put in Johnny and
Well,
somebody puts on NSYNC and it's just like,
That could be an interesting career resurgence. What if she comes back with like a powerful like Adele? Like I kind of like Adele, right?
Free but Britney.
If she came back and dropped clearly
an MK Ultra victim
that would be the name of the album.
Yeah,
would be like MK
the
Ultra.
Butterfly. Yeah.
It would be like, it would be called like Make Ultra Love or something.
Yeah.
But the M and the K,
Rainbows
like
and
that.
Things. Yeah.
But
the
M and the K would be capitalized.
Oh, God. Well, Brad, you did a great job. I really enjoyed that. And, you know, I love the image of the mirror painted black. You know, a lot of this stuff followed the track of what you already know from the biopic, but you went deeper.
I
just really enjoyed it. I can't wait to do Brando. I'm going to prep that.
I'm looking forward to that. Yeah.
Dude, it's going to be great. I think everybody who hears this knows where to find us, artofdarkpod.com. And Brad, thanks, man. I really enjoyed that.
Good. I'm glad. I enjoyed doing it, man.
All right, buddy. I'll see you on the Bird website.
All righty.
Later.
Bye.